Hi, it's Jen Taub. Welcome back to Booked Up, a podcast that features you, me, and our favorite authors. We release a new episode every Sunday morning. Today, my guest is journalist, filmmaker, author, and activist, Andrea Chalupa. You know Andrea from her award-winning podcast, Gaslit Nation, that she founded with Sarah Kendzior. Andrea and Sarah collaborated on the book we are discussing today called Dictatorship. It's easier than you think. They describe dictatorship as a wild ride, showing the perks and pitfalls of becoming a dictator and how to overthrow one. Part of that book focuses on Soviet leader Joseph Stalin's genocidal famine in Ukraine in 1933. Andrea is also the writer-producer of the award-winning journalistic thriller that was produced by MGM called Mr. Jones. It came out in 2019. Mr. Jones was directed by three-time Academy Award nominee Agnieszka Holland, who is known for her work on Europa Europa, The Secret Garden, House of Cards, and The Wire. And it stars James Norton, Vanessa Kirby, and Peter Sarsgaard. Okay, let's dive in. Hey, Andrea.
Hi, Jen.
How's life?
Life is good.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
You're the only person I know who would say that. Can you explain yourself, please? I want to hear.
I have a 4-year-old and an almost 2-year-old, so I have no choice but to be a joy factory for my children. So
that's true. Yeah. I have a new puppy and I have to be like a joy factory, and I've got still a teenager. You're right. So I can be a misery factory.
I'm not at the misery stage yet with my kids when they finally, where I can't, you know, they have to know what's going on. So right now I'm all tickles and silly faces and playing monster. But while I chase them around the room playing monster, in the back of my head, I'm like, oh, monsters are real. And I talk about them all the time on my podcast and my books and my films. And you're going to find all that out very soon,
but,
unfortunately.
You know, I mean, I feel like it's always been thus. You know,
Totally.
If you actually look at history, and that's like where the expressions eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you will die, or whatever. Maybe I got that wrong. Or just even like, you know, read a Shakespeare play, and it really is all comedy and tragedy. It's hard to see the in-between, honestly.
1,000,000,000%. And I feel like it's a really privileged attitude for people that maybe have been in America since their great ancestors committed the genocide, the original genocide or whatever. It's a very privileged attitude to sort of be outraged, or what's the word? To be in shock by how horrifying life actually is.
How power corrupts.
yeah, I guess.
Right.
It's just a lot of people that are just on fire, like, pulling their hair out. And it's just, this is how it's always been. It was actually worse, you know, and I remember, you know, just with the stories I grew up with in my family, like both sides of my family escaped the horrors of the Soviet Union. My grandfather, his hands were shaking at a party that my parents threw in California, where they're living at the time. And a doctor went up to him and said, oh, I'm a Parkinson's specialist. And my grandfather said in his broken English, no, KGB, because he'd been tortured.
Oh.
He'd been arrested and tortured. And so the stories I grew up with were just like hell. Like, you know, if you read Tim Snyder's Bloodlands, Tim is a friend of mine and he was the historical advisor on my film, Mr. Jones. He's who introduced me to Agnieszka Holland, who was like my last ditch effort to get that film made. And Bloodlands is what my grandparents survived, what my uncle witnessed as a teenager. And my uncle spent like 9 months or so in a psych ward because of all the trauma that he endured from seeing like headless soldiers dancing, their bodies still moving.
Geez.
And in this refugee camp where my mother was born.
In Ukraine?
This was in Germany. So the defeated powers of World War II became holding pens for like the tens of millions of displaced people before. So while the Allies could figure out what to do with them. And in this refugee camp is in the American zone, under the Americans. My grandfather took it upon himself to organize and produce the artists in the refugee camp, the artists. And through them, they put on Shakespeare in Ukrainian. They put on
Shakespeare.
So you know what I'm saying? So they were like, they had survived hell on earth. And their solution to all that, when they finally had the opportunity to catch their breath, was, we're going to make some amazing Shakespeare theater and we're going to have so much fun. And that's what they did.
It's Life is Beautiful, that movie, which I absolutely, Benigni's film. So I just feel like this is in medias res and I need to rewind. You were born in California, I'm guessing, because that's where you grew up. Mm-hmm. So go back to the pogroms, or can you tell me a little bit about the pieces of your history that informs why you became obsessed with the history of the Soviet Union and kind of where you are today? Can you go back to your family histories for me?
Yeah, so I grew up in Davis, California, which is UC Davis. It's a farm town in Northern California. It was originally called the Farm University. And I bring all that up because Davis was very Ukrainian. It was, even though my family and I were the only Ukrainians in town, we feeling very sort of loud and ethnic because of that. It was very Farmsville, very flat, very weedy, a lot of sunflower fields. So it was a very odd thing to be raised in this proudly Ukrainian family, right, with all the Ukrainian embroidered pillows and the Ukrainian Easter eggs and the Ukrainian food and the loud yelling Ukrainian parents and the unreasonable immigrant parent expectations. I was either going to become, my sister and I had to become president of the United States or news anchors on the Today Show. There's no in between.
I think we have the same family.
I don't know why.
Doctor or lawyer would be the fallback.
A trillion percent. If you must, that's where you go. and so my world, my innocence, and this is why, as you know, as a parent, anybody with common sense knows, the world that you give your little children is going to stay with them and sustain them for the rest of their lives. So the world that I was given was my grandfather. He would, when my parents were out, busy working.
Oh, so which side, whose father?
Mom's dad, mom's dad. He was born and raised in Donbas, Ukraine, which is a part of Ukraine that's been invaded by Russia since 2014.
Right.
He grew up speaking, thinking, writing in Ukrainian. It was Donbas, Eastern Ukraine, was a hotbed of Ukrainian national identity. And then Stalin came along, engineered a famine, deliberately mass murdered around 4 million people. Oh, sorry, 5 million people.
And just time frame wise,
1933 in a single year. And so
4 million people.
5 million, sorry, 5 million,
sorry.
5
Jeez.
Million. And the vast majority, around 4 million, were Ukrainian. And over time, they repopulated the area with Russians. And that's why Eastern Ukraine is so ethnically Russian. We're talking about that's a legacy of Stalin's genocide famine in Ukraine of 1933. And Putin, who has brought back statues of Stalin, who has glorified Stalin in Russian curriculum and so on, he launched his invasion of Eastern Ukraine, saying we've got to go save those Russians in Eastern Ukraine. So he's deliberately building off of Stalin's legacy there. And one of the first things the Russians would do when they'd take over an area in Donbass, you'd see these Stalin billboards going up.
I mean, wow. And so Putin is aligning himself with that bloody legacy.
Proudly
of
so.
Yeah. And you didn't mention so it's interesting, you're saying Ukrainian. Were you raised in any kind of religion or are you, because that can be complicated too. I mean, the people who are Russian immigrants that I remember from my childhood, I'm older than you, but I was born in the late 60s. And so in the 70s, it was all the Jewish refuseniks coming from Russia, right? So I didn't even think about the communism issue. For me, I didn't trust Russia, not because of the Cold War, but because of how they treated the Jews. And you're not mentioning a religion. I think that's interesting.
Yeah, well, religion was a big part of it. So my mother's side is from Eastern Ukraine, which is primarily Orthodox.
Orthodox Christian, that's where the Easter eggs come, eggs. Yeah,
yeah.
Okay, got it.
And then my father's side is Catholic from Western Ukraine. And their parents didn't speak at the wedding.
Wow. it,
by Ukrainian standards, that's a mixed marriage. And that divisiveness came in the refugee camps of World War II, the Ukrainian refugee camps. But in terms of Jewish influence, my father grew up with a lot of just my dad's mom would cook like gefilte fish. And my dad was convinced for the longest time that he was Jewish because he came from a village in Western Ukraine that was very mixed, a lot of Romanians, like a big melting pot.
Yeah.
And there's even a book written about what a significant melting pot that region of Ukraine was. And so he's like, I just feel Jewish. And he had all these Jewish friends that had made him an honorary Jew over the years. He's like, that's it. This is determines it. And then he went and got his DNA test. And even though it did not say anything like you are, congratulations.
No Ashkenazi and no, nothing.
There's nothing like that he was expecting. And he was, but then he's like, no. It's because they still say I'm from that part of the world. And that we know that there's Jews there. So in his mind, you know.
So he was this, your Baba, did he grow up with you in California and kind of talk to you about the old days? Is that how it became of interest to you or?
Yeah. So one of the first things, what was significant was that my grandfather being like my best friend growing up, just the coolest guy. He looked like a Ukrainian Don Draper, just a classic gentleman and very handsome and piercing blue eyes and just my oak tree. And, you know, that was my first big loss in life, my first grief, and it took me a very long time to get over. And as I was coming out of the teenage years in college, the world was becoming a wild place because of, you know, women my age entering this world. The role models we had were Britney Spears having a nervous breakdown and shaving her head.
These were in the
2000s.
Okay, got you.
So, you know, you have like Kim Kardashian sex tape, Paris Hilton sex tape. And I was like, I don't see myself in this world. And so I'm going to go back in time to my grandfather and hang out with him. And he luckily gave me a lifeline for that. He wrote down his entire memoir typed in Ukrainian on a Ukrainian typewriter.
What?
And I took it with me to Ukraine after college. I saved up a bunch of money. My parents couldn't say no. It was my own money. And I just went alone with his memoir. And I found a translator. And I bummed around Ukraine.
So early 2000s before, is this before the color revolution?
It was 2005.
Oh,
so
wow.
I was there right off of the 2004 Orange Revolution.
Orange Revolution, yeah. Oh, my goodness. Right.
Which was an extraordinary time of hope. Like, all of us were heartbroken because George W. Bush in America got a second term as president after the disastrous Iraq war and all of that. And the world was really down on that. But then Ukrainians kind of lifted us back up by leading a peaceful uprising. They just stood in the cold, freezing cold for weeks until a corrupt stolen election
with Viktor Yanukovych.
Was finally, you know, erased and redone. And then the pro-Western Democratic candidate won. So there was this wonderful energy there, like very open, very international. And so I went off to Ukraine on the heels of that. And I made lifelong friendships. I helped friends start a rock band. I auditioned to be a national news anchor. I hitchhiked. There was even one couple that was having an argument and picked me up off the side of the road to like settle the argument.
And how did you learn Ukrainian, or did you learn it from your grandfather?
Yeah, so I learned it growing up. I spent like a summer at Harvard's Ukrainian Research Institute, and then I just sort of just showed up, and it was fine.
I love that. There aren't many women. I am one of them, and I think you are, who will just be like, okay, I have to do this thing, research, and I'm just going to travel across the globe on my own. And every now and then, do you have this thing where you're like, what am I thinking? Like, how can I do this? But like, I think young men do that, right? I don't often look at myself and think what I'm doing is reckless or unsafe or extraordinary. And then, you know, but I'm listening to you tell this story, and it seems all of the above and also fantastic and exhilarating to just say, I'm going to go explore this area of the world and connect with the past. Okay. So that happens with you, like I said, 2005-ish. Is that when you were? Okay. And so let's start where we are now, which is kind of why we're here today, I think, to talk about two of your artistic projects. One is Dictatorship. It's Easier Than You Think, the incredibly powerful and also hysterically funny graphic novel that you co-authored, as well as, you were just mentioning a bit ago, this film from 2019 called Mr. Jones, incredible that you wrote and produced it. You have an incredible director, and it also, these two works overlap. So can you talk a little bit about the connection between these two, the intersection between these two pieces?
Yeah, so Mr. Jones was a journalistic thriller. When I was in college, I had this really crazy idea that I was going to make a movie to honor my grandfather and all like the countless millions who suffered under Stalin. I was very privileged that my parents exposed me to a lot of difficult movies growing up. And I was just thinking about this the other day. When I was a little girl in second grade, third grade, I had a huge crush on Tom Hagen, Michael, and Sonny from The Godfather, Godfather 1 and 2. Like, I was obsessed with those movies as a child.
Oh, my God.
Like, I would, like, daydream that we were all in, like, Sicily together on their olive orchard. And they were, like, my cool uncles who would, like, stand up for me against all the bullies at school. And, like, I lost myself in that magical world of Godfather 1 and 2. Not 3 because
filmed.
It's horrible, but 1 and 2.
Godfather 1, you know, is incredibly well filmed. And I guess the loyalty and protection aspects of it are important. I mean, for me, that, you know, the murder and chaos kind of overshadow that. But you do you. I love this. Go ahead. Continue.
So one of the movies that my mom took me to as a child was Schindler's List.
And
I felt this extraordinary.
That's a hard movie to watch. Even as an adult.
She took me there as a child. Like, but I'm so glad. I'm so glad that I saw it. And it's like, when I watched that movie, I knew that I was engaging in something necessary and mm-hmm. that provided some sense of justice. Like, I understood that the events happened in the past, but right. the fact that we were able to talk about them and learn about them and expose them and connect to them, like the little girl in the red coat.
Yes, that image, that's, yes, at the end, yeah. Yep.
And so that felt, that to me just embedded in me this sense of cinema. Storytelling can right. give back human dignity. It can give back names to the nameless. And so I wanted that for my grandfather.
And it can tell a story more globally than a book ever
Absolutely.
Could.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah. And so I set off on this really crazy mission. I had zero contacts in Hollywood. I didn't know how to write a screenplay. I didn't know what to do. Like, nothing. Like, I was starting from scratch. And it's a very misogynistic industry. I had some lucky breaks. For instance, Nelson George, who was the writer of the hip hop movement in Fort Greene, Brooklyn, he became a friend of mine. Like, we met at a concert at SOB Sounds of Brazil. And he was the first in the industry to take me seriously, which showed me how to take myself seriously. And that made a world of difference. And Nelson was someone.
Can I just say something? Mm-hmm. If someone spoke with you for like either 30 seconds or 5 minutes, they would take you seriously. But go ahead.
But it's just, I think young people just deal with such like a, they have so much confidence in some ways. And in some ways they can really.
Yeah, that's true.
Because they're desperate. They're desperate to know what they don't know. And to,
yes.
Yeah. So with Nelson, he invested in Spike Lee's first films, which launched indie filmmaking in America. He discovered Chris Rock. And one thing he taught me was that don't be afraid to be interesting. He came across so many people who are trying to sound how they thought they should sound instead of just saying what needed to be said. And that was very freeing.
Say that one more time? Because I just wrote that down.
Don't be afraid to be interesting. Don't be afraid to be interesting. And so I wrote a really sort of unusual screenplay dedicated to my grandfather. And it was research I had done during my time backpacking in Ukraine alone. It brought together this real story. It was inspired by the real life, independent, idealistic Welsh journalist, Gareth Jones, who at a young age in his late 20s, risked his life and career to sneak inside Ukraine under Stalin and to witness what they were doing there during the famine and to go out and report on it.
He's in the book.
He's in the book.
Dictatorship.
Yeah, he's in the graphic novel and he's the source of the film. And I tell that story through him, this extraordinary journalist. And he ends up, you know, his death is tragic. He's killed under mysterious circumstances on a reporting trip. And now we know that he was traveling with people connected to the Soviet secret police. So his ending sucked. And so what I needed to do was to find some sort of larger meaning to his story. And for that, I turned to George Orwell. And so what I discovered was that George Orwell picks up where my young hero, Gareth Jones, Mr. Jones, my film, leaves off. And where Gareth got the reporting out, Orwell takes that those facts, that reporting, and turns it into a work of art, which is Animal Farm. And that is Orwell's breakthrough novel that brings the atrocities of Stalin to a much broader audience and endures today. So I weaved Orwell into my screenplay like a Greek chorus. So you see, the film opens with Orwell writing Animal Farm, the words that narrate the young man's journey of fighting to get the truth out of Ukraine. And it becomes a reminder that history is watching. You'll be judged by history. The truth will always prevail. And to get that very ambitious historical film made, I turned to, you know, I didn't know what to do. I had to basically teach myself how to produce a script, how to write a script, how to ask for money. And long story short, I raised several millions of dollars. I found the director, the great Agnieszka Holland. We brought the team together across Europe. The actors are extraordinary. James Norton, who was in Greta Gerwig's Little Women, and Vanessa Kirby, Peter Sarsgaard. If you love acting, if you think acting is just delicious, it's like the acting across the board is mesmerizing throughout Mr. Jones. And every day on set was just a magical collaborative experience in terms of the energy. Even in the smaller roles, they were cameos for that country. So great actors would play great actors from Poland and Ukraine and Scotland, where we filmed. Those smaller roles were filled by extraordinary giants from the stage, from film in those countries. And when I was on set in Scotland, when we were wrapping up Mr. Jones, I would watch American Twitter on my phone and go, oh dear God, I don't want to go back there. I don't want to go home.
Oh God.
So what I did was I called up Sarah Kendzior and I was like, we're going to start a podcast. And I flew straight from set to Sarah's apartment. Sarah's house. And we recorded like the first three episodes, and that launched Gaslit Nation. And as we're running Gaslit Nation, like getting the vote out in the big midterm elections, getting the vote out against Trump, and really putting it all out there, like all of Trump's real confirmed Russia connections and what they mean and how dictatorships operate. We kept going on and on the show about the dictator's playbook. Here's the dictator's playbook. Here's all the ways Trump is doing the dictator's playbook. And an editor at a wonderful press, First Second, they reached out to us and said, would you guys want to do the dictator's playbook? And so that's a miserable book to write because it's like Machiavelli. But so we had this idea of doing it through like Stephen Colbert when he played Bill O'Reilly, where you have this
truthiness.
Truthiness narrator. So we had this really sleazy Cary Grant-esque narrator who is the pitch man for he's like the Mark Burnett of what, like, you know, what Mark Burnett did for Trump with The Apprentice. Like that's what our pitch man, the star of our graphic novel, Gaslit Nation presents Dictatorship. It's easier than you think. So it becomes this whole, the graphic novel is like this big Ivanka Trump infomercial and how to live your best life through disinformation, through destroying your enemies, through consolidating your rabid mob supporters, scapegoating, and building a cult of personality, and then how to try to stay in power. And ultimately, the book is a lesson on holding up a mirror to the reader and saying, you have the power. These guys are idiots. We've just showed you how they operate. There really are idiots, we promise you. Like the footnotes are all here. You can see that they are over the top ridiculous. And so now that you know how they work, it's up to you to help us stop them. And so it's sort of like a musical comedy version of Hannah Arendt.
So it's just a gorgeous book. And, you know, I wish I had, speaking of reading things when you're too young or seeing them when you're too young, this would be a like great book for anyone in middle school or high school, even though it's a tough topic. The drawings are fantastic. And I want to ask you about that before I talk about some of the themes, but did you just give the text to an illustrator and like came up with a storyboard, like each panel, or were there some things where you made notes in the margins and said, here's what we're thinking of? Like, how did that collaboration work?
So we wrote the text and we provided image ideas throughout, but obviously it's such a rich book of illustrations that she came in. So the artist is Kasia Babis, and she is a human rights activist based in Warsaw who wow. has put her body on the line protesting the abortion ban in Warsaw and fighting to protect the refugees that were being flown to the border of Belarus and Poland by Russian forces to try to flood the EU with refugees from the Middle East and Northern Africa. And so she was part of a big movement to try to bring food or what was needed to those refugees and speak out for their human rights. So she herself is very much on the front lines of fighting the authoritarian threat. The government of Poland, which was finally voted out thanks to a big old liberal coalition, but it took them a long time to figure that out and to get that together. But the government of Poland that was just voted out was very Trumpian. They purged the courts, they took over state media, turned them into propaganda apparatuses, and they created these hate zones. They scapegoated LGBTQ people and refugees, even Ukrainian refugees before Putin's total invasion of Ukraine. In the early years of that war, even Ukrainians who were in Poland felt the hostility. And so she was dealing with all of that. So a lot of her own energy went into the art, which is why it's so intimate and packs such a punch.
I think some of my favorite images here is when there was like, was it like, is it Hitler and Stalin who are like tweeting, like what their tweets would say? Like, I'm sure that was her invention. It was, but so in here toward the beginning, what the book talks about is kind of the ingredients for dictatorship, you know, and this is, so you want to be a dictator. This is that first chapter. And the five ingredients that you talk about, which is something that you've written about elsewhere, of course, is the first is fake populism, meaning acting like you're on the side of the public, maybe who's suffering, which is common, some economic downturn or what have you, and saying that you alone will fix it. The second is demonizing the press. Third, scapegoating groups and often groups that are already vulnerable, minorities of any type. The fourth is use of propaganda. And the fifth is getting the military or mob or militia on your side. Did I get that right?
Mm-hmm.
So now what do I do next? Like, I might be a benign, like, let's just say I could be a benign dictator. Like, I could make people do things like, you know, get rid of their front lawns and plant gardens, and I could make people recycle. I mean, I don't know, but imagine that, right? If there's a benign dictator, what are the tools beyond those five things? What does a person need to do to be a dictator?
Well, do you want to start a benign dictatorship together? Like, we can create like like bee gardens, you know, like this, plant those special flowers that the bees
like Barbie,
love.
Like the Barbie, first
exactly.
half of the Barbie movie.
Totally.
Like dance parties, can we? And pink, and every day is good.
Yeah, well, we're seeing it now. I mean, it's the three ingredients. So the book, the graphic novel, Dictatorship, It's Easier Than You Think, opens with a cooking show. And it is the three ingredients, which unfortunately we have right now, which is economic instability. I know people talk about Biden economics and the jobs that are out there, but the reality is the tax cuts for the uber wealthy that Trump and Ivanka pushed mm-hmm. through, they're being paid for by the middle class.
Absolutely. And inflation, you know, my friends, I have some friends who are like, oh, there isn't inflation. I'm like, listen, I don't make the kind of money you do because my wages have been stagnant for years, and inflation in the last, like, it's killing me now. It's killing us. Don't you agree?
Absolutely. I don't know about- 1,000,000,000%.
And I'm not blaming Biden, but that's it's a reality.
It's the
rich. Problem.
It's the oligarchy that we're sneaking, that America is like, you know, the reality is we're living in a time of historic levels of income inequality. It's worse than even during the robber barons. And it's become so normalized in America that for us just speaking out and saying, this is a danger, a lot of people are falling through the cracks. And the heartbreaking stories of people who consider themselves middle class and how close they are to living in their cars or already living in their cars. And if you walk by in New York City, if you walk by long lines to get into, let's say, like a food bank, you just see such a diverse mix of people of various ages. And you just see a lot of people, especially who, you know, are maybe living off their Social Security, and they need to wait hours in line at a food bank because they don't have enough from their Social Security. So it's all around us. Like, there's economic catastrophe all around us. And it's the reason why we don't talk about it enough, because unfortunately, the newsrooms are shrinking across America. And the conversations that are dictating cable news are the culture wars that the far right is like deliberately engineers to create a strategy of distraction and divide. And when the reality is, when we should be working together to fight all this together and to build together, because we're all being hurt, blue state, red state, whatever you want to call it, like, we're being all hurt across the board. So we have that component right now. One of the most important ingredients of how a dictatorship starts is economic instability. And then add to that political instability. I don't have to go into that because we already know we just had this massive fight for a speaker, and Trump's proxy is now third in line to the succession of President of the United States. That's very scary. And then you have Tommy Tuberville, who's threatening our national security.
Wait, last night, and I know this is, I should be like, we're talking on November 2nd, Thursday, and this is probably going to be airing, you know, obviously not today, on some other Sunday, but last night, what happened? Were they voting on, like, did they actually vote on 300 different nominations in Syrium? How do you say that? In Syrium? Did they actually vote on everything last night because he was holding everything up? Or do you know what happened?
He won. He won yet again.
Oh, no.
And, like, the reality is that what he's taking advantage of is a norm. And so what people need to be aware of, that us alive right now in this moment in American history, we need to be banging on the drum, just screaming loudly for modernizing the American government. Like, we need modernization of our government. Like, this should not be allowed to happen in this year. You know what I mean? There's certain rules going back, like the filibuster. I know that I'm so tired of the filibuster debate, but Adam Gentleson wrote an extraordinary book on how the filibuster has historically been used to slow down civil rights, civil progress, and so on. But yeah, so we just need, like, modernization movements for the United States government. And and Tommy Tuberville is somebody that I think is going to radicalize people in that direction and bring us together.
But let me back up. How do we do this? How do we actually build grassroots coalitions? I understand how the strength of labor unions is fantastic, right? We have the auto companies, the big three, I think, all settling their labor disputes. And maybe there might even be now, I think, you know, maybe even Tesla may get unionized. But I think building coalitions through labor unions, because then that those are groups that can communicate. But, like, the ambition is getting rid of the filibuster. Like, as you noted, like, there are people who don't know where the next meal is coming from. And that number keeps increasing. I mean, I think in Massachusetts, I just saw the governor said that they're, like, completely maxed out in terms of shelters for families. And we actually have, I think, whether it's a constitutional amendment or some law in the books, I think it must be a law that says we have to provide housing for people in the state. And they literally don't have the space anymore. And the numbers, it's like, I think the number was something like it used to be 5,000. Now they're talking about 8,000 families. And I was looking at the numbers and the math, and, like, it was like per family, the cost, maybe the math I did was wrong, but it was like $100,000 a year. And I'm thinking, that's for temporary shelter? Like, what? Like, there's something really broken inside of the system if you have to spend that much money in the back end rescuing people in a temporary measure because they cannot make ends meet in this economy. But with all of that happening, how can people even, like, how could you go up to someone and say, yeah, I know the line's really long at this soup kitchen, but do you want to get rid of the filibuster with me? I mean, how do we do this?
Well, I think you always communicate to people, no matter what state they're in, whatever they're dealing with, like, that they have options, that they have power, that this exists. And whenever they're ready, it's there for them to get involved. And I think for us that have immense privilege, if you have a home, if you're not, you know, struggling to put the next meal on the table, if you're not in survival mode, which wreaks havoc on your adrenal system, on your health. If you have privilege, you're morally obligated to use that power that you have to give voice to all these issues, to have these conversations, to consistently have these conversations, and to communicate them in a mainstream way as much as possible, and just keep having the conversations and build coalition. There's no way getting out of this unless it's together. We have to build coalition. So any sort of toxic personality, any sort of ego, any sort of infighting along this broader coalition, just ignore, drown it out, punch up, focus up, and really name and shame the 100 corporations that are raking in money, polluting our planet, driving the climate crisis. Like, make those CEOs famous, make their boards famous, expose who they're throwing political donations at, and then go after basically the corporate puppet masters.
You know, thank you so much, because right now we're like in so many different crises all happening at once. And it's sometimes it just feels just emotionally crushing and like nothing matters. But when you remind me, you know, those people who have tremendous, those organizations with tremendous power are maybe happy about the distraction because the heat's now off them. So maybe like turning my attention to that again would be helpful. And speaking of which, I want to turn our attention to, there's something, there's several different things I want to talk about that I forgot related to power. But the first thing is, before we get to that, is something in your official bio. It wasn't in the book, but it was on your website. I want to read it. And it said, Andrea's mother and father were both born in displaced persons camps in 1945 Europe. The dictatorship of the Soviet Union that her grandparents escaped has been one of her major preoccupations since childhood, leading her to discover a priceless, and you put in quotes, gift from George Orwell in her family. Is that a metaphor, or was there some actual gift that you got from George Orwell?
I should probably run. I could even run out and show you. It's I keep it in my closet. Well, as I mentioned earlier in our conversation, when I was struggling to write my screenplay, I turned to George Orwell for inspiration, and then he ends up a character in my screenplay. And he's played beautifully by the British actor Joseph Mollet, who played Uncle Benjen on Game of Thrones and just is a stunning actor. So when I was researching George Orwell and getting inside his head, I read how he spent years struggling to publish Animal Farm, a book that no one wanted to touch at the time, because we were using Stalin, one monster, to get rid of the other monster, Hitler. Never mind that Stalin and Hitler united.
That was what I was going to mention. I didn't know that till that only came up recently in history. But continue.
The Nazis and the Soviets got World War II started by jointly invading Poland. They even had joint military parades in Poland. And that's what got World War II started. And you can't say that in Russia today, because you'll get arrested. But we say it in the graphic novel. Anyway, so Uncle Joe, as he was known, our great World War II ally, made Orwell's book Animal Farm dangerous. No one would touch it. And in fact, there's even a spy in the Ministry of Information that killed a publishing deal for the book that Orwell managed to get. He lost it thanks to that Russian spy. And
thanks to Uncle Joe.
Yes. And so finally, a relatively small press publishes. They wait until the war's over and they publish a limited number of copies. And one ends up in the hands of a Ukrainian hipster stranded in Munich, like so many were. Because remember, Germany was the holding pen. It was like Germany basically was turned into a massive refugee camp for the displaced people. It's like, what do you do with these tens of millions of people? We just round them up, keep them in Germany until we figure out what to do with them. And so one such refugee in Munich who learned English by listening to the BBC, he discovered Orwell through that, got his hands on a copy of Animal Farm and immediately understood that Orwell was telling his country story. And he hunted down Orwell.
His country, meaning Ukraine.
Yeah, like Boxer the Horse being this, you know, sort of this exploited collective farm. And so he hunts down Orwell's home address in London, writes him a letter in flowery broken English, and says, I've already started translating your book into Ukrainian. We have a group of refugees here that are, you know, artists, writers. We would like to publish your book in this independent press in Ukrainian and give it out to the refugees here. And Orwell was so excited. He even tried to get his friend Arthur Kessler, who wrote Darkness and Noon, to give them some of his books. And so when they were about to publish the book, this refugee writes again, to Orwell saying, I'm sorry, but people don't understand how you knew what was going on in the Soviet Union when so many did not. So could you please explain to us, who are you and how did you know the truth? And this is a significant question because Orwell put it in his will that he never wanted a biography written about him ever, because he understood that any life under scrutiny would be embarrassing. And so he ends up writing this heartfelt letter to these Ukrainian refugees, telling him all about his childhood, his life, his honeymoon fighting fascists in the Spanish Civil War with his wife, and all the ideas that inspired Animal Farm, thinking that who's ever going to read this? And they translate it into Ukrainian, and they make it and he even gives him a photo, a really cute photo of himself. And it's a photo of him like rolling a cigarette, like looking very shy and like hipster brooding and cute. And they put it into the book as the preface. And when my uncle was a teenager in this refugee camp in Germany, the refugees organized themselves. So if you were a teacher back in the old world, you became a teacher in the refugee camp. And so his teacher in the refugee camp said, oh, there's this new book called Animal Farm. It's in the canteen. And so my uncle got it, this Ukrainian translation of Animal Farm. And the Ukrainians had deliberately changed the translation from Animal Farm to a collective farm of animals to blast the brutality of Stalin's collectivization. And when my grandfather, who inspired Mr. Jones, when they could finally make it to New York City by boat, like going through New York Harbor, seeing the Statue of Liberty, they could only take what they could carry. And one of the things they took with them was Orwell's Animal Farm in Ukrainian. And I didn't know any of that when I included Orwell in my screenplay. And so when I was...
Are you kidding me?
No, I didn't know any of that. So when I was catching up with my uncle in his farmhouse in the Catskills and telling him, you know, I'm still working on that screenplay after all these years. Yeah, I'm still, you know, silly Andrea with her screenplay. And I told my uncle about how I made some changes. Orwell's now in the book. And I was inspired to put Orwell in because of his connection with these Ukrainian refugees. And my uncle looks at me and he goes, oh yeah, I have a copy of that book. And my aunt went up, like, shot up from the table, went to the bedroom where he kept the book in his bedroom. Keep in mind that they lived in a farmhouse. They had a full-on library. My uncle taught the novel at Rutgers University. They had a home library, but they kept this book next to their bed. And he brought it back and gave it to me. And they're like, it's yours now. And so now I have it. And what's amazing is that young hipster refugee that started that whole project went on to open the Harvard Ukrainian Research Institute, where I studied Ukrainian. And his daughter lives in Park Slope right next to me. And she messaged me through the Gaslit Nation website. And we're like in touch now. So
can you please send me a photograph of the cover? Is it an illustrated cover, or is it just
gorgeous?
Pretty bare bones?
So the refugee that made the cover went on to become an illustrator for the Washington Post. The cover is like this pig, a menacing pig holding a whip. And in the background, you see a silhouette of Boxer the Horse, like being worked to death.
I would love to see you now and get a screenshot of you holding that. Is it nearby?
Yeah, do you want to wait? Want me to go grab it?
Absolutely.
Okay, 1 second.
Okay, you're back.
I'm back. Are you ready for this?
I'm not fucking ready for this. I'm so excited.
Okay.
So can you say the words that say it out loud in Ukrainian?
Kolhosp, tvarin. Kolhosp. Kolhosp is a collective. Tvarin, collective farm.
And can you lift it a little higher so I can see the bottom? My gosh, that is gorgeous.
Is that beautiful?
How about the spine? What is the spine?
The spine is just destroyed.
Yeah.
From years of.
Wow.
And then let me show you the photo of Orwell. And this is.
Be careful. I don't want you to hurt
it. So there, I don't know if you can see this, but that is the publisher.
Go move it over. Oh, I see.
They call the publisher Prometei, which means Prometheus in Ukrainian.
Wow.
And that's the photo Orwell sent them. This is from Orwell himself. This photo.
Rolling his cigarette.
Yeah. This is what he wanted. That's how he wanted to show himself. Is that amazing?
So all this kismet here, like, I live for things like this. And just this that you were drawn to him. I mean, just all of the pieces of how this came together. I'm so glad that the movie that you were already in the process of writing this when your uncle gave you the book. I mean, now will you please add to your renter's insurance policy this as an itemized thing that you're insuring?
Yes,
because I think it's priceless.
I'm going to do that now, thanks to you, Jen. Like, really.
But I don't want to tell your address to anyone. No, I'm not kidding you. You need this. Actually, I know. Just so happens, most of my friends are connected to the world of rare books. My husband is he makes artist books, which are sort of handmade. They're either letterpress or etching or other. This is like, he's like a William Blake type person, but his world is connected to the rare book world. So, for example, the Library of Congress Rare Book Room that has a Jefferson Bible, they have antiquarian books, but they also collect artist books like my husband's books that he makes now. So these worlds are together. And a good friend of ours, I mean, there are a lot of people who appraise books like this, but I'm really afraid that this is a sort of priceless thing. And I think you need to get it insured. And you should keep it, but you should also think about it being a bequest for someplace at some point.
Thank you so much.
I mean, Harvard has the Houghton Rare Book Library, which I know the new curator there. Who's kind of amazing. I don't want her to steal it from you because I know it's important to you, but it's also something that you just don't want if there's like a fire in your apartment. This is something of historical meaning and so on. Listen to me. I'm like lecturing.
No, I love it. I bought a fireproof box off of Amazon and I spent a while researching trying to find the best one. But if your husband has any ideas for me on how to store it, because I called a rare bookshop and they just said, don't touch it. That was the only advice they gave me, was like, don't touch it.
Well, no, sunlight, one of the most important things is keeping it away from sunlight and also in temperature control. But like touching it, I mean, a lot is bad, obviously. But I think someone like, you know, the rare book librarian, you know, well, you're in Brooklyn, I'm trying to think. I'll give you some names. I mean, there are some rare book librarians, you know, that would know what to do. I'm surprised a rare bookstore didn't ask you to buy it from you. They didn't?
I just asked. I don't know. The guy may have been busy at the counter when I called.
Yeah. No, I mean, this is kind of an incredible artifact. And I love that he's never done, as you said. I mean, is it true that he never had a real biography and this is the only... Have you translated
in
that
his
into
lifetime.
Has anyone translated that in English?
Yeah, so the Ukrainian translation was translated into English. So the letter is out there, and I included it in I included Orwell's preface in my book, Orwell and the Refugees: The Untold Story of Animal Farm,
okay.
Which gives the sort of colorful pictures of who these refugees were. And I mean, after the Soviet Union, the refugee camp was heaven on earth for them. And they just flourished in this intellectual society. They would have these inter-pan conferences, bringing together the leading thinkers of the different refugee camps. And when my uncle came to New York City as a teenager, he took a test to place. He said that when he was so advanced compared to the New York City school system that he was able to skip a grade because of his education being so good. Back
in this refugee camp where they're putting on Shakespeare.
Yeah, exactly.
and asking, writing letters to George Orwell. I mean, this is kind of like, can I just say your next movie has to be about this camp?
1,000,000,000%. Do you understand? 1,000,000,000%. I see it visually. I can feel it, but through the eyes of a child, right? Like the wonder.
Yes, yeah. Totally.
You know the movie 100%. Once Upon a Time in New York?
I don't think so.
Okay, so there's wonderful scenes where you see these boys growing up in the Lower East Side and you see New York City through their eyes. That's how I would see it, but for like a World War II refugee camp.
Amazing. Well, I mean, I'm now remembering when I was a guest on Gaslit Nation, I was like, we should just have a pajama party together and hang out. So like, we have to do that at some point. I have a lot going on with, you know, overcommitted and a million things. But if I'm ever in New York, I'm just going to show up at your door. Is that okay?
Uh-huh. 100%. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
but you've got these kids and like you've got two kids. I've got two dogs and a teenager and like life is impossible, but we'll figure it out.
Yeah. Well, the kids are in bed by 8. So come over after 8 and then we have all night. And Olga,
that's great.
Olga Lotman's here. So we'll, yeah. And so we're going to have like.
Oh, so fun. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, what did I mean, I know I didn't ask you 5 million different things, but what is there anything that you really wanted to talk about I guess we didn't talk about the famine. We sort of did.
Yeah. So this November is the 90th anniversary of the Holodomor, Stalin's genocide famine in Ukraine. And it's significant because for so many reasons. But one reason is because when he got away with mass murdering millions, when the Nazis were running in the election of 1933, they were saying, don't vote for the communists. Stalin's killing their own people. So Hitler was able to use it to drive a wedge against the left in that election. And ultimately, one of the things that Hitler did when he was appointed Chancellor of Germany, one of the very first things he did in his first month in power, I think it was in March of 1933, he began building the first concentration camp, Dachau. Mm. And within 6 months, he was dictator of Germany, attacking the legal system first. And so I think the important lesson, the Holodomor happened first, and Stalin got away with it, and Hitler took notice, and then he began immediately building the Holocaust, knowing that the world would do nothing. And the world did do nothing for a very long time.
Can you talk, and one thing you explain in the book, but we haven't explained the Holodomor, like how what he was doing to the farms specifically that resulted in people's, you know, like you said, I think you just told me 6 million people starving.
So 5 million. That's a conservative estimate.
I keep changing the numbers.
That's a conservative estimate.
I keep changing. Yeah, yeah. Right, 5 million and then 4 million of them were Ukrainian.
And
sorry,
what the Soviets did was they laid the groundwork of a genocide. And this is important to point out because it's happening today in America. They use genocidal rhetoric, genocidal media to attack Ukrainians. And they're doing that today in America against LGBTQ+ people, women, non-white people, and so on. And it just become normalized genocidal rhetoric on the right in that echo chamber. So that's what the Soviets were doing against Ukrainians. They even had films produced showing, with dramatizations of Ukrainians being enemies of the people and refusing to join the collective farms. They had a whole propaganda operation, and they sent in agents, they sent in these activists, and they commandeered the agriculture, the grain. They sealed the borders of Ukraine so the starving couldn't get in, so the starving couldn't leave. They were stuck inside there, and aid couldn't get in. Journalists were forbidden from leaving Moscow, and people were left to die a slow death. And they even seized and destroyed cooking utensils, ovens, anything people could use to feed themselves. I interviewed one survivor who described how she and her brothers were boiling mud and twigs and leaves on an open fire to eat, like, because that was a very common thing. People would eat like a muddy foliage, from the forest, whatever they'd pick on the ground, just to put something in their systems. And she described how Soviet soldiers came regularly searching for food, and they even just took their muddy stew and dumped it out. So that was before a nuclear bomb. That was before, Hitler perfected like the Henry Ford mass murder execution of the concentration camps, like really took it to a new level. So Stalin committed mass murder by engineering a famine. And the hero of my film, Mr. Jones, was the first to call it man-made. He was the first to really blow the lid off this thing and remains an extremely important eyewitness. He was able to sneak in. His story is remarkable. Like when all the journalists of the day, the famous journalists like Walter Duranty of the New York Times, who had just won the Pulitzer for basically publishing Soviet propaganda in the New York Times, those journalists were confined to Moscow. And they're all, many were doing drugs and having lavish hedonistic parties. This was during the avant-garde movement of like the 1920s and 30s. And Gareth didn't drink. Thank God for that, because he just was bored out of his mind in Moscow, and he was able to name drop and really sort of come in like with his swagger and as this young, confident man and convince the Soviets that he was there from London and that London was interested mm-hmm. in what their factories were doing in Ukraine. And so the Soviets themselves sent him on a trip, thinking that they're rolling out the red carpet for Westminster. And he eluded his KGBS, his secret police escort, and got off the train and just trekked by foot through ghost village, and interviewing the survivors and promising to tell their stories. And so it's a really, really beautiful role model of history for what to do now in standing up against global corruption and disinformation and dictators. And I hope people check out Mr. Jones as well.
Well, thank you so much for this incredible conversation, sharing your absolute brilliance, your eloquence, your knowledge, and your heart with us today. How can people find you and your work?
Well, they can listen to Gaslit Nation, which comes out Tuesday nights. We have a wonderful episode coming up on how to start a union featuring a Starbucks barista and their stories of how they organized. Highly recommend people listen to that because we need to get more unions right now. That in building political power, building economic power, just year after year after year, that's how we're going to get out of this crisis. And the stronger our economy is for everyone, with no one left behind, the stronger and safer our democracy. Because it's these dictators that come in through scapegoating, through fake grievances of their own and so on, that pit people against each other. And that's what we see in the graphic novel. So listen to Gaslit Nation. Come hang out at our slumber party where we're going to cook up more ideas. You know, I can workshop my next film with you. I'm so excited for that.
Yes. So good. Well, thanks so much. I this has been great.
Mwah.
Mwah. Andrea is an absolutely fantastic interlocutor. She is incredibly interesting, knowledgeable, generous with her time, and utterly brilliant. And I feel like I'm not even trying to be a flatterer. This is who she is. I look forward to more conversations with her. I've been a guest on Gaslit Nation. Now I'm so glad to reciprocate and have her here on Booked Up. And although I, of course, read Dictatorship, I have not yet seen Mr. Jones, and I am going to immediately, like literally upon signing off, find it so I can watch that this evening. I'm amazed at her versatility. I'm amazed with her strength, and in, to some degree, kind of the fortuitous nature of what has come together for her. You know, just thank you again for being part of this conversation with us. And I will be back next week with another show as we continue to explore the writing process and the nonfiction world together. Please let us know what you think. Send an email to bookedup@politicon.com. And you can also write to us by, you know, with a postcard or a letter, or even send us a book at P.O. Box 147, Northampton, Massachusetts, 01061. To keep up with the show and our featured authors, please follow Booked Up on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And please give Booked Up a 5-star review. It really will help other people find the podcast.